Currents Facebook page at facebook.com/topicalcurrents. Join the conversation, post a comment, share links, and see what other listeners are saying at facebook.com/topicalcurrents.
And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents, Monday edition. Joseph Cooper with you, along with Bonnie Berman. Welcome back from vacation, Bonnie.
Thank you. Good to be back.
Good to have you. Well, this hour we examine mounting instances of investment and financial fraud with a panel of experts. In the studios, the managing director and senior financial advisor of the Westcott Financial Advisory Group. He's Joseph Nader. Welcome to you, Joseph Nader.
Thank you for having me.
Also, it's Eitan Mark. He's a certified fraud examiner with Miami's Berger Singerman Law Firm. Welcome to you, Mr. Mark.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
And also with us is FBI Supervisory Agent David Nanz, the White Collar Crime Program Coordinator for the FBI's Miami Field Office. Welcome to you, Agent Nanz.
Thank you.
So, gentlemen, financial fraud is nothing new. When and why has its incidence skyrocketed? And whichever one of you wants to take that.
Well, we've definitely had a lot of, publicity and media reports of financial fraud, certainly since the mortgage meltdown and everything else. But, having done this for about 11 years for the FBI, I'm not sure that the amount is so much more significant than it was before. Keep in mind, going back, Charles Ponzi was orchestrating his scheme in the 1920s, and there were many, many financial frauds after him. And certainly even before the financial crisis in the FBI, we were investigating hundreds and hundreds of investment fraud schemes, well before Bernie Madoff and so forth. So from my perspective, these schemes have been going on for a long time. We're certainly hearing more about them, which is a good thing to help investors be more alert. And some of them are becoming more sophisticated, but the volume has been high for many, many years.
Is it sort of like theme and variation that it's the same old plan, but different disguises and different ruses?
I think that's right. I think it's always the promise to make a high rate of return on your investment, but the type of investment has changed. So, for example, recently with the increased prices in precious metals, we've seen, particularly in South Florida, precious metals boiler rooms operating down here, basically pitching the investment that, hey, with the international economy having problems and everything else, gold has increased in value. Here's your opportunity to get in on the ground floor. And the problem is that the people pitching these investments are not actually investing in gold. In fact, they're taking the people's money and then using it for their personal use. So,
what do they use it for?
High-end automobiles, lavish lifestyle on South Beach, everything else. And the money goes out almost as quickly as it comes in, which is why we always try to tell people, know who you're investing with. If you do want to invest in gold, that's fine. Just don't do it with someone who cold call you and who you don't know.
Joseph Nader, what pressures make people victims of fraud most commonly?
Well, that pressure is one of the key components to what we've traditionally seen as sort of the three-pronged approach to understanding why fraud occurs. There's rationalization, there's opportunity, and then there's a third set that involves pressure, need, and greed. It can be something as simple as an infirmed family member. It can certainly be the everyday pressures of corporate folks in publicly traded companies where you've got demands on quarterly financial performance. And then that other sort of category can be just those who are wired a bit differently and who see the opportunity. They rationalize it, and their way of being is simply fundamentally tilted towards doing wrong. Pressure is everywhere, but it should not be something that we look at in an isolated way. When we've looked at, over the years, and I've been in the financial services industry now for 20 years in combined roles around wealth management as well as banking, if the opportunity is in place, breakdown in policies and procedures and whatnot, you tend to have those individuals where pressure takes over, rationalize that kind of behavior, and you find fraud being committed.
Who oversees financial advisors to make sure that their investments offered are sound and that they're not scams?
There is an organization called FINRA, which does oversee financial advisors. And in the event somebody is being, and of course there's the SEC as well, and in the event somebody feels that they have somehow been given the wrong kind of advice by their financial advisor, and bad advice usually is not enough, then there's of course remedies that they can pursue either through FINRA, and if it rises to the criminal level, then you could make the appropriate disclosure to the Department of Justice or to the U.S. Attorney's Office.
And I would just add, you know, one of the things that we tell people, it's so important to do their due diligence, and FINRA was mentioned. Well, through their website and also the SEC's website, there's something called Broker Check. So you can run the name of someone as well as, to see if, in fact, they are a licensed broker, if they do work for a legitimate broker-dealer, and also whether they're a registered investment advisor. So I always tell people, you know, would you take flying lessons from someone who was not a licensed pilot? Probably not. So why would you invest your life savings with someone who's not a licensed broker or registered investment advisor? So those are what two areas on the web that you can go to and find out if in fact your person is a legitimate investment advisor or broker.
And what is that website again?
Well, it's finra.org,
right,
is the website.
Okay, and that's...
you can find the Broker Check link on that website.
Yeah, and that's a great point, because you can also see, when you do that broker check, you can see what kinds of disciplinary action, if any, have ever been taken against this particular broker advisor in the past. And it is something that is so typical of so many of the clients who are victims who come into my office. They haven't taken many times the initial steps to investigate what is this investment opportunity really all about.
Joseph Nader, Eitan Mark, and FBI agent David Nance joining us on today's Topical Currents. Tell me, gentlemen, is there a higher incidence in Florida of fraud because of so many retirees and immigrants? I know there's tremendous medical fraud here.
Yeah, I think there is, and I previously worked out of our headquarters in Washington, D.C., and saw what was going on in all 56 of our field offices. And definitely we have in South Florida one of the highest, rates of financial crime. And, I think people can debate why that is. I think part of it is the transient nature of South Florida, as well as the fact, there is a lot of new money in South Florida, whereas, an investment fraudster operating in Vermont who buys a shiny new Lamborghini or Ferrari, that's going to raise some eyebrows. But here in South Florida, it really doesn't, because there's so much of that
right.
sort of flash around. So these people are sort of able to just sort of, melt into the community, and doesn't raise eyebrows when they quickly go from not having any money to a lot of money.
Would you say that seniors are the most vulnerable target, or who else is targeted?
Seniors are, of course, a very vulnerable target. But what I've noticed is that there's a tremendous amount of affinity fraud in South Florida. That is, that there's pockets or clusters of demographic units that seem to be targeted as a group. Typically, those relationships arise from trust or something to that effect. In other words, it might all be members of the same church.
Okay.
There was a recent scheme involving the folks in Wilton Manor. So it was a significant gay population that was targeted with a particular investment scheme. So, and usually what happens is, because of the transitory nature of South Florida, you have people who don't know a lot of other folks in the area, who find their niche, trust people, and then often, unfortunately, fall victim to these kinds of financial schemes.
How much of the fraud is due to the internet and other modern technologies?
Well, I think there's a lot of fraud that is taking place now electronically. And there's a couple of different ways that's happening. One of the ways that's quite pervasive is the taking over of one's email account. So, for instance, and we've had, over the last couple of years, I've personally been at firms where we've experienced attempts at this. And policies and procedures have mitigated the actual fraud. But clients' emails are hacked.
An example of that.
Yeah.
A client's personal email is hacked. There's been prior communication with the firm and the advisor via that email. And then instructions are given by that client to the advisor in a very personalized way. I'll get an email from a client, as an example, and I'll say, "Hi, Joe. The prior communications may be attached to that particular email, and there may be instructions to transfer money to a third party." And it'll all seem very familiar. Now, if a firm doesn't have the proper policies and procedures in place, such as callbacks, et cetera, you could fall victim to that very easily. And we know that this is happening quite a bit. So that's one way that you're seeing electronically fraud being committed now.
So the person hacking the email will actually go and follow the thread and actually get hold of the money?
Not actually get hold of the money, but they'll be able to see correspondence with that particular client's advisor, and they'll communicate with that advisor and request that money be transferred to an account that they control, a third party account.
We're speaking about investment fraud today on Topical Currents. Our guests are Joseph Nader, Eitan Mark, and David Nance. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and 91.5 WKWM NPR for the Florida Keys. South Florida Theater League and 91.3 WLRN offer same-day half-price tickets at leading regional theaters and cultural organizations, including Orchid at the Pleasure Garden, Broward Stage Door, Women's Theater Project, and Actors Playhouse. Information and a complete list of shows online at culturalconnection.org. culturalconnection.org, your ticket to the cultural arts.
If you're looking for motivation to keep you running or walking through the spring and into summer, Team Footwork's Spring Half Marathon Training Program is designed to do just that. Starting February 23rd, this 17-week program will train you to compete 13.1 miles. It doesn't matter if you walk or run, the goal is fitness. Information is available at teamfootworks.org or at 305-666-RACE.
We're funded by listeners like you and by the Lincoln Motor Company, introducing the 2013 MKZ Hybrid, a luxury car with an EPA estimated 45 miles per gallon. More at Lincoln.com. Actual mileage will vary. We're also funded by ConservArt, specializing in restoration and custom framing for the care, conservation, and displaying of fine art. Insurance claims are a specialty. A complete list of services offered is at conserveart.net.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. And we continue our conversation about financial fraud and investment fraud with Managing Director and Senior Financial Advisor of the Westcott Financial Advisory Group. He's Joseph Nader. Also, Eitan Mark, a certified fraud examiner with Miami's Berger Singerman Law Firm, and FBI Supervisory Agent David Nance of the White Collar Crime Program for the FBI's Miami field office. If you'd like to join in, you're certainly welcome at number 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN, and email, that's radio@WLRN.org.
And Mr. Nance, we were talking during the break about seniors, and you wanted to add something about that.
Yeah, in the FBI, we definitely view senior citizens as a vulnerable group, and we repeatedly see that group targeted and through many different types of scams. I did want to mention just a couple so that people are on the lookout. Some of these have been going on forever, but in particular, the foreign lottery scam, which probably most people are familiar with. And I always tell people, if you haven't been to Australia, you're probably not going to win the Australian lottery.
Anybody fall for that Nigerian business?
They do, and there's a lot of variations in the Nigerian scam. But if I can just say a couple things, if you really have won a lottery, you're not going to be asked to pay upfront fees. And that's how this works. They say you have to pay the taxes and so forth, and they want the money wire transferred typically via Western Union or MoneyGram, where it's very difficult to trace. So just be on the lookout for that. A trend that we're seeing, something we refer to as the grandma scam. This is where through websites and other computer databases, people are able to identify familial relationships. So what they'll do is they'll call a grandmother, grandfather, and say, "Hey, I'm a lawyer in the Philippines. Your grandson, Johnny, is here. He got arrested at a bar, and he needs $2,000 to get out of jail." And unfortunately, more often than not, that grandmother, grandfather will actually transfer that money to the Philippines before determining whether or not that is actually a true case. I actually get a complaint about every couple days of someone in South Florida who's victimized by that very scam. So, you know, sometimes, you know, you do have to exercise a little common sense, but just being careful and doing a little due diligence will help avoid a lot of these problems.
Any others? I heard about these equity indexed annuities. Maybe one of you other gentlemen can talk about those that are targeting seniors. No, would that be you? The equity indexed annuities?
I haven't received any complaints on that. But I can tell you, you know, just one other area that's very common I wanted to touch on. Has to do with the passing of bogus cashier's checks, official checks, certified checks. There are so many of these floating around that if you receive a check from someone that you don't know, assume that it's bad. And if you're going to deposit in your bank account, wait for it to clear, which sometimes can take, you know, 5 to 7 business days. What happens is people are selling something on eBay or Craigslist, and the scam goes like this. Let's say you're asking $500 for a watch. Well, the person contacts you, I'm going to buy it. But they send you a check for $1,000. Well, that doesn't really make sense, does it? But they ask the person to then wire transfer back the difference, the $500. So the person, not knowing that it's a scam, deposits the money. They wire transfer the $500. And then 5 days later, the bank says, that check was bad, and we're going to charge back your account. That is very, very common. In fact, it's even victimized some South Florida law firms. You wouldn't expect attorneys to be victimized by that. But all I can say is there are thousands and thousands of these bogus checks floating around. They're done up on these high-quality laser printers in Nigeria, Dominican Republic, other places. They come to the United States. And again, assume that the check is bad until it actually clears.
And just to build on that, there every once in a while I'll get an email from a prospective client, usually from a foreign country, that says something to the effect of, I'm owed $5 million in child support, usually something that has nothing to do with my expertise as an attorney, because it's just spam, and I'd like to retain you. And when attorneys get an email that says, I'd like to retain you, they typically get very excited about that,
right.
At which point they would send you a, quote, retainer check in a certain dollar amount, and then tell you, oh, you asked for a $50,000 retainer or a $10,000 retainer. I gave you a $25,000 retainer. And then asked you to send back from the firm's trust account the difference. So even attorneys, I mean, theoretically, one of the more sophisticated groups in South Florida are victims of these scams.
And why do you think they would fall for something like that?
You know, I don't really know the answer to that question. I think that there's obviously... In enthusiasm, perhaps an over enthusiasm to get a client engaged. The same things that attorneys advise their clients not to do, attorneys themselves do all the time. You know, they don't conduct the adequate investigation. They don't even the most basic due diligence. They're put under these alleged time pressures to return the money, to send it back, which is a huge red flag.
Right.
Well, it can also come down again to a process and procedure within an organization. And organizations of different sizes and different approaches to that can find themselves more easily victimized. If you have a law firm where a check comes in and it is processed by an administrative department, someone will obviously match the name to the client, and the dollar amount will look different, but the check will still get deposited. And this is, again, goes right to, you know, policy, procedure, how are things being looked at, and understanding that this is happening and things need to be tightened.
Yeah, so there's been this belief over the years that if something says it's a cashier's check or a certified check, then that's good as gold. Well, you got to understand, technology has really advanced when it comes to these laser printers and other things. Anyone can print these up in their basement, and they are. And they're sending them out by the thousands, and they hope if only 5% bite, right, they've made their money.
I think it's also important to distinguish that kind of circumstance can produce two outcomes. One can be net fraudulent, and the other can involve actual money laundering. If the dollar amount, if the check is good and came from a foreign location, and it was a $5,000 retainer and the check was for $25,000, and you refund $20,000 to that client's United States account, you have legitimately put $20,000 into that client's United States account. So
if someone overpays you for anything, be suspicious.
always.
Should be always. A huge, well, huge red flag.
Certainly it's a red flag. Yeah.
So if it's too good to be true in all of these cases, because what are the, how do we know when to take advantage of an investment opportunity?
Well, you need to do your research. You know, again, going back to who you're dealing with. Are they licensed? Are they a registered investment advisor? But a big thing too is,
but wasn't Bernard Madoff a registered investment advisor?
He was. You know what? And that's not a perfect system. It's one step. And I was going to add to that is, so often is the case that in the FBI we interview victims of investment fraud and we sit down with them. Okay, what exactly was your investment? And they can't explain it. So you know, we always tell people it's so important to understand the investment. And if you can't understand it, don't invest in it. And if the person selling the investment is not willing to give you full disclosure, because sometimes these fraudsters, they say, well, this is a secret trading program. I'm not at liberty to share the materials
you're
with
getting
you.
Getting in on the ground floor.
You're getting in the ground floor. This is not available to everyone, just you. Those are all red flags. A true investment, they're more than willing to give you a prospectus, full disclosure about what the investment is. They should be licensed, registered, and so forth.
Certainly, and to add on to that, once you've done your due diligence, if you decide to move forward with that investment, it becomes very important how you execute on that. If you are purchasing an investment through an account that you own, it is titled in your name, and it is custodied at a large, reputable custodian, you have taken the first step to mitigate the potential risk associated with that investment. Certainly, the risk is that that investment could lose value. But in talking about how fraud tends to be perpetrated, you've taken one very big step to reduce the potential for fraud. If that investment requires you to transfer directly your money to a third party where you no longer have control, they are generating statements that will describe the dollar value and all of that associated with your investment, you have put yourself in a position to not be able to accurately understand A, what you have, B, where it is, and C, to do anything else related to it. And you've also put your advisors in a position to not be able to do their work for you either. That's a bit of that in great deal is what happened in the Madoff situation. He certainly was reputable. If you did any form of checking at the time,
he was with the SEC.
He passed all of the reputation risk hurdles. In fact, it was difficult to get money to him if you didn't have certain access. But what we later found was the money was custodied by him and his firm. The reports, the statements were generated by the firm. There was really no way to look closer into it if you were skilled or you retained folks to do that on your behalf. There was no degree of transparency. So once you've done that kind of homework to ascertain whether or not you want to make an investment and whether or not the individuals are licensed and reputable, you really have to understand the structure around which you're going to make that investment.
So there should always be a custodian, a third-party custodian?
Well, in the case of working with a registered investment advisor who's going to build and manage a portfolio, say, for retirement, there should indeed be a reputable third-party custodian. And that custodian should have their own set of procedures. You should be aware of what they are to mitigate fraud. There should be statements that are sent to you that are generated by that custodian in addition to any form of a performance report or a summary report generated by your actual independent financial advisor that produces a series of checks and balances. These are some of the common ways to look at the relationship you have with an independent investment advisor once you've decided to engage that. And if you find that that investment advisor has taken custody of your assets and is producing statements and is in control of the whole process and there is no setup checks and balances, that is certainly a red flag.
Let's take a call before our break. This is Patricia. She's in Coral Gables. Hi there.
Hi. I'm calling about fraud regarding income tax, stolen identity, loss of return on income tax.
Okay. Yeah,
this is a big problem. It's no secret the FBI has a number of investigations into this area with our partner IRS Criminal Investigation. And you know, we've interviewed a number of the perpetrators, some of who in their prior lives were dealing with drugs and everything else, and they've told us this is so much easier than dealing drugs, and it's much safer. And the problem is that the these checks, the refund checks, are being sent out so quickly that the IRS staff, you know, doesn't have the sufficient time to do their due diligence to see if it's, you know, the rightful recipient. And one of the things that we tell people, a couple things, because we've discovered that some of the perpetrators are obtaining Social Security numbers of people through healthcare facilities. So what I tell people is, when you go to that dentist or you go to the doctor to be treated for a flu, when you check in, they say, give me your Social Security number.
Right.
Don't do it. They do not need your Social Security number. They're just taking it as a way to track patients. But guess what?
It's just routine for them.
It's just routine.
I thought that was required at doctors.
It is not required. And we've seen where a staff member might be making $10 an hour. They then sell that information. So never give your Social Security number.
But, you know, often, excuse me, just interrupt, your contract number for your insurance company is your Social Security number.
That's correct.
Then you have to give it.
And shame on that insurer. A number of insurers do not use your Social Security number.
Medicare does.
FAA pilot's licenses used to use a Social Security number as the pilot's license number, and they stopped. They realized that it was subject to fraud. And one other tip I would give people is file your returns early, because to the extent the fraud perpetrators do have your information, if you're able to get your return to the IRS in before them, then you won't be the victim of the fraud.
Patricia, did you want to ask something else?
She's not on anymore.
Oh, she's not on anymore. Okay, it's Topical Currents. We're speaking with Joseph Nader, Eitan Mark, and David Nance. And we're taking a short break, and we'll be right back.
This is Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and 91.5 WKWM, NPR for the Florida Keys, streaming online as well, WLRN.org. You've reached a certain age, you're viewed as a success, still, you are not immune. The disease of addiction doesn't discriminate based on age or status. West Palm Beach's Hanley Center is considered a center of excellence for comprehensive addiction treatment and recovery for older adults and baby boomers. Hanley Center for Older Adult and Boomer Recovery. Details at 855-718-2233. Hanley Center, Recovery for Life, 855-718-2233.
If you're having a hard time selling that old car or truck or just don't want the bother of selling it, the WLRN Vehicle Donation Program can help. Just call 877-WLRN-CAR, 877-957-6227, or donate online at WLRN.org. Donating is easy when the tow truck comes to your home and picks up the vehicle. They give you the paperwork that you'll need and relieve the stress of what to do with the old car that just won't sell. That's 877-WLRN-CAR or donate online at WLRN.org.
North Korea delivers a blunt warning. Expect another nuclear test. And the country's new leader insists its arsenal of long-range rockets is designed to hit the United States. I'm Neil Conan. Why North Korea works so hard to maintain us as its mortal enemy, and what drives these latest threats, plus the opinion page. Next, Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Coming up right after Topical Currents here at 2 p.m.
And it is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman, and we rejoin Joseph Nader and Eitan Mark, and also FBI agent David Nance. Let's take another call quickly. We've got Mindy in Boca Raton. Hi there.
Hello, how are you?
Good.
Good.
Yes, I have a question. What does one do when you have an adult grandchild that executes a premeditated extortion plan on elderly grandparents, and we were involved in a very heavy-duty lawsuit, which ultimately cost us $85,000, and of course we won it, but this individual keeps coming back, and she tries to open accounts under my parents' name, and it's a life where we live. We don't always look over our shoulders, but we're certainly very cognizant that certain things may be happening.
We can't be giving you any specific legal advice, Mindy, but generally, who'd like to touch on that?
I'll take a crack at it, and thank you for that qualification, because I can't give any specific legal advice. But what I will tell you is that, you know, it's obviously when it involves family, that's one of the examples of when it's crushing. I mean, it can really tear a family apart, these kinds of things. And if you have an adult grandchild who's taking advantage of his grandparents, which is what it sounds like the case is here. There are civil remedies and there's criminal remedies. Depending on what the nature of what it is that he's doing, you could, of course, always report him to the applicable state and federal authorities. You can also do something called get an injunction. You can file a request with the court. Usually it would be the federal court. It could be the state court, depending on the nature of the violation, asking them to enjoin him from taking certain actions. For example, it would be akin to a cease and desist kind of a thing, where he's not permitted to.
Should she start with the state attorney's office?
It's hard to know where to start without having a little bit more detail. Yeah.
Well, it sounds like she's already done something because she said she spent $85,000 already on legal fees.
Right. It sounds like that the civil suit has already run its course. But nonetheless, you could now at this time seek injunctive relief from the court. Probably this very same civil court that you've already obtained your verdict in. And that may be an additional protection that you can afford your grandparents or your parents.
And this individual is a female. And is there a statute of limitations? This took place about 7 years ago this month, to be exact. And I'm not sure. Well, the lawsuit went on for almost 2 years, but I'm not sure exactly if there's a statute of limitations. I just feel badly. My parents are almost 90, and I'm trying to protect them from any further. But they also don't want to have any more problems. So it sort of puts me in a funny position.
Of course. Well, Mindy, if there's an ongoing fraud, then the statute of limitations isn't going to begin to run until the commission of the sort of most recent act of fraud. And it's a 4-year statute of limitations. So depending on when you knew or should have known of the fraud occurring, that would be when the limitations period begins to run.
I see.
Okay, Mindy, we have to run.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mindy.
Thank you.
Eitan, you wanted to add something about the IRS tax return fraud?
I was speaking earlier today, actually, to my father-in-law, who does this, who's a criminal and civil tax attorney in town, and the amount of fraud that he's seeing with respect to income tax filings, which Mr. Manns referenced earlier, is just through the roof. There's a tremendous amount of it, and there was a suggestion to file your income taxes early, and that's really good advice. If you can do it, you should file your tax returns early now, because then when the IRS receives the fraudulent tax return, they see that that was a subsequent filing and they're able to reconcile or not reconcile.
So they'll catch it at least if it's
filed
twice.
Okay. It's more likely they'll catch it. And it goes back really to what you were talking about earlier with why is there so much more fraud here or it seems like there is. And Social Security numbers are just easy to get now. It's easy to find somebody's Social Security number. You don't have to be a genius. I mean, a lot of the filings in court now, even though you're not permitted to file somebody's Social Security number in court, people do it. So if you have a lawsuit filed against you and perhaps it attaches a mortgage, your Social Security number may be on that mortgage, and if for whatever reason it wasn't redacted. And that's something that, you know, again, we're seeing a lot of.
And what do we do to prevent identity theft, especially online? What can one do?
It's hard. It's hard. I haven't bought something other than food in a store in probably 2 years. I buy everything online. You know, you have to be very careful about what information you put online.
I think nowadays a lot of that onus is on us individually. I think you have to be looking frequently at your bank statements, at your investment account statements. You have to be tracking your own activity. There are services. There are reputable services that you can pay fees to, and they will produce alerts for unusual activity and help with the process. But nothing certainly is foolproof. But
what kind of services are you talking about?
There are a couple of sort of nationally known companies that I certainly wouldn't want to be in a position to be construed as providing any endorsement to.
Okay.
But, you know, clients have engaged those kind of services after some identity theft has taken place.
You can.
What are the best known?
LifeLock was an example of something along those lines. A Trusted ID may be another example of those. They certainly are means to mitigate But I think that the best thing you can do is to protect the your personal information. We've talked about that. And then to stay on your own activity for unusual events that may occur around your financial life.
I know a lot of people are wary of using their credit card numbers online, and yet they will give their credit card to a waiter who disappears for 10 minutes. He definitely would have your account number.
Yeah, it's funny.
And your security thing on the back.
There was a big case in Washington, D.C. a couple years ago where in some of the high-end restaurants, there was a ring of people actually skimming the credit cards. And what's interesting, you go to some European countries, even Australia, and they actually swipe the card at your table in front of you, so the card never leaves your custody, and that's a security thing. A couple pointers from the FBI perspective and protecting your information. Obviously, people probably heard of phishing scams. Never give out your information if, you know, your bank is never going to call you and ask for your social security number. That should be a red flag. You're never going to get an email from your bank, even though the email might look like it's coming from Citibank or Chase. They're never going to ask for your social security number. And another thing, too, is with the increase in Wi-Fi spots, whether it be at the public library or the airport or McDonald's, whatever the case may be, never, deal with sensitive information while you're at those sites. Don't check your account balance with your brokerage firm or your bank, because other people can intercept those communications. Likewise, when you go to the business center at a hotel while you're on business, some fraud perpetrators have attached key logging programs to those business centers where they're going to track everything that people type in. So, little common sense sometimes. Do your banking at home, not at McDonald's.
Right.
Sure. But again, look frequently at your credit report. Look for unusual activity in your bank accounts and investment accounts, and watch the activity in your own life, and that will help. And also know that if something were to happen and there's unusual activity in your bank account, you contact the bank, you file the necessary paperwork, your account is usually almost immediately restored, and you go through a normal process. That would be the clients often don't realize that's the way that works. And in the case of working with a reputable custodian for your investment accounts, there is insurance. If a crime is committed, you need to be able to know that there is recourse, and that those organizations carry insurance.
Our telephone number, if you'd like to join in, 1-800-743-9576. Next caller, it's John. He's in Miami. Hi, John.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I was a victim of identity theft. Someone had broken into my car and took some papers and actually a checkbook I had. And to go back on something that was recently discussed, that was about 2 years ago, and I signed up for one of these activity monitoring sites. I think it was through Experian or one of those companies, Trusted. And they did discover a lot of activity. They were trying to open up new credit card accounts or accounts at retailers, and having this in place, it was roughly $8 or $9 a month, but it did give me peace of mind that that things later on over the years, over the last couple of years, there hasn't been any activity, but I do keep that monitoring up, and it's given me some peace of mind that this, maybe identity theft has subsided. But a question I did have was related to checks. And the checks that were stolen, they were forged, and the individuals cashed them at check cashing stores. Now, I had immediately notified my bank that the checks were stolen. They put stop payments on them, but the check cashing stores ended up cashing them anyway. And then kind of to add insult to injury, when my bank ended up denying payment, the check cashing stores tried to make a claim against me, and they weren't successful. But I was wondering, and I've heard many people who have had checks stolen and then they're cashed at these check cashing stores. What culpability or role do these check cashing stores have in identity theft?
Who'd like to take that?
David?
Well, I could tell you this. In terms of local regulation, state regulation, you have the Florida Office of Financial Regulation, which is responsible for a lot of that stuff. And the FBI, we don't certainly get involved with regulation. I can say what we've seen, however, is that at a lot of these cash check stores, the level of due diligence that they do is not what you would see at a bank. And a lot of them can be fly-by-night and open 1 month and gone the next. But in terms of their liability and everything else, that's something that, you know, you'd have to speak with the Florida Office of Financial Regulation.
Okay, John. Thank you very much.
Okay, John. It's Topical Currents. We're speaking with Joseph Nader, David Nance, and Eitan Mark about financial and investment fraud on today's Topical Currents. Please stay with us. We'll be right back.
And this is Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and 91.5 WKWM, NPR for the Florida Keys. WLRN Radio and the Miami Herald will hold a town hall meeting on Florida's upcoming legislative session. This live free event is Monday, February 25th, 6:30 p.m. at the Broward Center for the Performing Arts. You can reserve your seat now at WLRN.org.
You do not have to postpone completing the bachelor's degree you started years ago. St. Thomas University accepts your past college credits in its flexible, accelerated online bachelor's program, which can be completed in 15 months. St. Thomas University also awards credits for your work experience. Classes start March 10th. St. Thomas University also offers the 12-month online master's degree in executive management. Additional information at stu.edu/OL and at 305-474-6848.
Hello, it's Bonnie Berman. Join us for Tuesday's Topical Currents. It's devoted to the domesticated dog. Why do canines play such a complex and important part of so many human lives? We'll speak with New York Magazine executive editor John Homans, who's written about his mixed Labrador, Stella. Bred from wolves, man's best friend is incredibly adept at reading human eyes and body language. Homans has written, What's a Dog For? That's Topical Currents Tuesday at 1 o'clock.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. And we're speaking with the Managing Director and Senior Financial Advisor of the Westcott Financial Advisory Group. He's Joseph Nader. He's been giving some great advice. Also, it's Eitan Mark. He's a certified fraud examiner with Miami's Berger Singerman Law Firm. And also, Supervisory Agent David Nance, the White Collar Crime Program Coordinator for the FBI's Miami field office.
I wanted to talk more about the Social Security number that we were talking about during the break. So when to give it, when not to give it?
Well, I think you need to ask yourself, you know, if someone is asking you for it, why do they need it? Now, certainly when you're opening up a checking account, a brokerage account, and so forth and so on, when you're applying for a job, you know, they do e-verify and other things to make sure you're a citizen or you have a green card, whatever the case may be. But a lot of other entities don't need it. Perhaps they're asking for it just as a matter of convenience, as a number to track their clients, but they don't really need to do that.
So hospitals?
The only thing I would say is, you know, there may be certain situations when you're first, filing Medicare or Medicaid claims and so forth, and I don't claim to be an expert in that area, and people should consult with Medicare or Medicaid before they release the information. But I'm talking in general, your local dentist office, your local pediatrician does not need your Social Security number.
Many of them just ask for the last four digits.
That's becoming more common, which is better than asking for the whole number.
But you almost never want to give it online. I mean there'd be very few and limited circumstances where I would want to give or suggest that somebody should give their Social Security number online.
What about the credit card, like Experian and Transamerica, and don't they ask for it?
Well, when you're applying for credit, right, you have to give your Social Security number so that whether it be a car loan or a credit card company, so they can run your credit. But just make sure that it's a legitimate company that you're dealing with when you're providing this Social Security number.
Let's take another caller, then we'll get back to our panel. This is Dick. He's in Wellington.
Oh, yeah. Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, lovely. Two big quick questions. The first one has to deal with when the defrauder is over the telephone or through the mail and they're out of state. The question is, what recourse? Who do you call? Because this happened to a friend of mine. She lost $100,000, and the local authority said, because it's out of the area, we can't do it. So out of the state or out of the country. And then the other question is, in this specific case, the bank hadn't transferred the money into the defrauder's account yet, which was out of the country. And the question was, what does the bank have a duty if they've been notified that it's fraud to hold put a hold on the transfer or something like that?
Let me
it eventually went through, and the bank didn't. Anyway.
Let me touch on the first question. Generally speaking, under the federal criminal statutes, there must be an interstate nexus for the FBI or another federal agency to get involved.
What does that mean?
What it means is basically the transaction had to cross state lines, whether it be an email, a fax, a mailing, whether it be the U.S. Postal Service or Federal Express. So we look for that interstate nexus, and if there is, then we do have the discretion to get involved. And to the extent the caller, you know, has that situation, sounds like he may, he should report that to his local FBI office.
Great. Great.
Does that answer your question?
That's very helpful. So you could just call the FBI and say, I want to report a crime, and then what, do they give you a form to fill out or something like that?
Well, two things, sir. You can actually come in during normal business hours to our office on Northwest 2nd Avenue, or you can call us at 305-944-9101, and a duty agent will talk to you and take your complaint and route it to the appropriate FBI squad.
Okay,
thanks for your
call. Before we run out of time, how to some contact information from you, Mr. Nader, and also Eitan Mark, people who want to contact you.
Sure. Eitan Mark, it's E-T-A-N, last name Mark, M-A-R-K. I'm an attorney at Berger Singerman. That's B-E-R-G-E-R-S-I-N-G-E-R-M-A-N. You can reach me directly at the office at 305-714-4360 or by email at emark, E-M-A-R-K, at BergerSingerman.com.
Joseph Nader, Westcott Financial Advisory Group. We're located in Coral Gables. The office telephone number is 305-960-2303. And my email is jnader@westcott.
As in Ralph.
As in Ralph. jnader@westcott.com.
And David Nance, you want to repeat yours?
Yeah, our address is at 16320 Northwest 2nd Avenue, North Miami Beach. Again, the telephone 305-944-9101. Or you can email a complaint to miami@ic.fbi.gov.
I'd like to talk more about what one does to report something. If it's not, I mean, we just found out that they go to the FBI if it's crossed state lines. What else can they do and what do they do for different scams and schemes?
What I've been seeing a lot of is clients come in to our offices and they say, look, I think I've been scammed. And they tell us about what happened. And it depends. You know, there's different agencies, state agencies, local agencies, federal agencies.
Each county has consumer advocates also.
Exactly. There's just a large number of places to report somebody's bad acts from the government level. And then, of course, there's civil and criminal remedies available as well. So it really depends on the nature of the scam, and who was scammed, and by whom.
We have some callers and emailers who say that Medicare uses Social Security number for IDs. Is that correct?
I don't know about that, but that's a conversation the person should have with Medicare.
It's been two or three different people had mentioned that, so you might want to look into it. And maybe complain about it if they're doing that.
Yeah, and the same with doctor's offices. And also, you were saying about credit cards and restaurants. Is there any movement to get that done in the United States where they do it, swipe it right at the table?
I haven't seen that, but I know as a person who goes to restaurants, I certainly would support that.
Yeah, really.
Well, it's been a pleasure. I also want to apologize to those callers we couldn't get on the air, including Dwight and Ann and Kevin. And we've been talking about investment and financial fraud with our panel of experts, who included Managing Director and Senior Financial Advisor of the Westcott Financial Advisory Group. He's Joseph Nader. Thank you very much, Mr. Nader. And also Eitan Mark. He's a certified fraud examiner with Miami's Berger Singerman Law Firm. And also, we've had FBI Supervisory Agent David Nance, the White Collar Crime Program Coordinator for the FBI's Miami Field Office. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
And that wraps up today's edition of Topical Currents. Richard Ives is producer, technical direction from Caroline Brader-Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. And tomorrow's program is devoted to the surprising history, science, philosophy, and politics of man's best friend, the dog. How can they read humans so well? You can find free audio archives and downloads of past programs at our website. That's WLRN.org. Also, author and book links, discussion, photos, and more at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Drop a like, see Bonnie Berman's picture. And a mixed bag calendar for January 28th on this day in 1939. 74 years ago, the death of Irish poet and Nobelist William Butler Yeats in France at age 73. Cast a cold eye on life, on death. Horsemen pass by. And Ooh La La, on this day in 1950, 63 years ago, the birth of Playboy model, actress, and TV figure Barbie Benton in New York. Playboy After Dark. And one more before we say goodnight, Mrs. Calabash, wherever you are. On this day in 1980, the death of vaudeville broadcast comedian and language butcher Jimmy Durante at age 86. He was an accomplished jazz and ragtime pianist. Inka Dinka Doo. So we conclude with Jimmy Durante. Quote, be awfully nice to them going up, because you're going to meet them all coming down. This is Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
This is 90.